Welcome to Roadcase, the podcast that explores the live music experience. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg, and I'll be taking you on a journey through in-depth interviews with performers and key people in the industry to explore the magic of live music, how it can be totally transformative for both fans and performers, and we'll look at how they take it all out on the road. It's going to be a great ride, so here we go. Hey, welcome back to Roadcase, everybody. Really psyched to be here. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg, and I'd like to welcome everybody to Roadcase for this episode with Tara Perkins. If you're here for the first time, welcome to the Roadcase community. And if you are a continuing listener, thank you again for your support and welcome to this episode. Really happy that everyone is here. As I do on every podcast episode, I like to remind everyone that there's this number of different ways you can get involved in the Roadcase community. First is simply to follow us on the socials. We're at Roadcase Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. So check those out. Give us a follow. You can also check out our website, www.roadcasepod.com, for more information on the show. If you'd like to email me with any questions, comments, maybe even suggestions for guests, love to hear from you. Promise that I'll get back to you. My email is info@roadcasepod.com. Love getting emails. Another great way you can support Roadcase is to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. So if you're on Spotify, you just click that check mark on the upper right-hand corner. And also rate and review this podcast is a great way and an easy way to support Roadcase. So if you're on Apple Podcasts, for example, you just slide down a little bit and look at see the rate and review section, click on a bunch of stars and write a review. That's a great way to support Roadcase, and I really appreciate your support. So for this episode, I got Tara Perkins with me. She's a tour manager of the band Gossip and Beth Ditto and Lower Dens and Velvet Negroni, transitioned eventually into band management, but started out running a touring performing arts show in the early 2000s and some live music fest around that time as well. Tara's a really very much of a true DIYer, and we'll hear a bunch about kind of the DIY mindset and ethics that she was really involved in. She's had her own band management company now for about 13 years called Hardline Management, and her live music experiences kind of really run the gamut. She took Gossip out in a van following Cyndi Lauper's tour, so she's really seen big stadium tours to tiny basement shows to everything. So really think you'll enjoy this episode. Really happy to have Tara here. Thanks, everyone, for being here for this episode of Roadcase. And thanks especially to Tara Perkins for being here on this episode of Roadcase. And here we go. Hey, Tara, how are you? Great to see you finally, now that we've figured out the all the technical stuff.
Yes. Great to see you.
Yeah, definitely. So you're back. You told me you're in the hinterlands outside of Portland. Is that correct? Did I understand that correctly?
I live in a tiny town on 20 acres on the Clackamas River.
Wow.
About 40 minutes outside of Portland. It feels very different out here. Yeah.
I mean, clearly you're able. Is that kind of like a COVID year hangout, or is this your the place where you kind of retreat to, or is this kind of your permanent sort of place that you run your business out of and everything?
It happened during COVID. I lived right in Portland for 13 years. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. It, you know, I was like 15 minutes from the airport. And now, you know, it's sort of been, I wanted to live on a river and had been looking for a while. And then this came up sort of at the beginning of the pandemic. And yeah, I can't say I was sad to move to the woods during the pandemic.
For sure.
You know, there's a guest cabin out here and lots of space for people to come and visit. So it's kind of worked out really well. to have space during all this.
I like being in the isolation, kind of like, or, you know, in the woods sort of thing, or not around a lot of people sometimes, like for vacation or stuff. But I sort of like, I like the urban area. It would kind of like be way too quiet for me to live out in the way out there like that. Like, it's not even that way far out there. You said you're 30, 40 minutes outside of Portland. That just seems like a lot for, that's not for me. Like I just did vacation like in Topanga Canyon LA.
Awesome.
And that was,
yeah.
And like for 3 or 4 days, that was killer. But I could jump into the car, windy road, back down into the main Topanga Canyon road. And then I'm down on the, you know, there's a beach nearby in like 10 minutes. So, you know, and you're on Pacific Coast Highway in LA. Like, so it's like that kind of isolation I like, when it's like, yeah, it's isolated, but no, it's like cool. Like 5 minutes later, you're in like the whole thing, you know.
It's so minutes from everything, and like so much stuff is, I mean, Topanga Canyon is like everything's going on around you. There's so much,
it's
so many
cool
studios and so many people doing stuff in that canyon.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool. You got to go, definitely have the morning coffee in the plaza there, because then you can like meet people, see what people are doing.
Totally.
Like, I'm interviewing everybody I meet, and stuff. They don't know it though.
They're like, I have this.
But after
podcast.
A while, they like think back, like, this guy. No, like later on in the afternoon, they're like, you know, this guy's asking me a lot of questions. It was really weird.
This guy got a ton of information about me, and I don't know who the hell he was. That's a skill, though. It's great. I mean, and people love to talk about themselves. People love that.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. Well, let's see if that's true for you, too.
I'm actually pretty sure about it, but yeah.
Oh, well, we'll fix that. You know, you're among friends. It's not like a lot of people are going to be listening to this. No, I'm kidding. A lot of people are going to be listening to this, but it's all good. So, now you have this Hardland Management where you're managing artists, but, kind of talk to me a little bit about your background in tour managing and tour directing and that kind of world.
I sort of stumbled into it. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, but moved to Olympia, Washington when I was 19. And there's sort of it's famous for the DIY aesthetic there, which is true. I mean, I wasn't into the K Records scene much at all, but it was this sort of magical place where you could spend $168 a month on rent and live so cheaply that you could pretty much do almost nothing employment wise and still exist. And,
perfect.
And it just led to people, this, everybody just had a ton of time on their hands, and people would, you know, their Lady Fest came out of there, Yo-Yo Go-Go came out of there, Homo Go-Go, all these big DIY festivals that were important, and you know, some of the Lady Fest managed to spawn a really a global host of other festivals, and you know, that the Riot Grrrl scene epicenter was kind of there, and it was just this idea that if there was this feeling in the air that if you wanted to do something, you just could go do it. Like if you wanted to have a show, you just did it. If you wanted to make a festival, you did. You go ahead and do it. And
right.
I started out doing this project called the Sex Workers Art Show that was sort of a music, spoken word, performance art show that was all people who worked in the sex industry in some capacity. And that was first a local show in Olympia. And then I was like,
let me back you up for a sec. So that was sex workers that are also artists, or it was photographs of sex workers. Like, what exactly was it?
It was, it had a visual art component. So there were, you know, we did hang a gallery show at the same night of the performance, but we would, in the early years, it took place at the Capitol Theater. It's like an 800 seat theater in Olympia. And it was all people who'd worked in the sex industry, but were also performance artists of some kind. So there would be, burlesque, acrobatics, some amount of, you know, drag, people reading story, you know, all kinds of stuff. And, right. you know, as it went on, I was able to bring people internationally to join the tour and sort of screen for, screen for talent and sanity, maybe a little bit more than I knew to do in the early days. And there were, the curation of the show improved a lot over time is what I guess I'll say.
Yeah. Well, what was it? That's a very interesting concept. Sex workers art show. Like, was it to promote awareness about, that industry or to help those that were in that industry but wanted to get out, or was there a social justice kind of, motivation? What was the motivation behind it?
You know, it was definitely, I mean, the phrase, even the phrase sex worker wasn't widely used at that time. Now I almost fell out of my chair. I embarrassingly watch, CSI, and they use the phrase sex worker on CSI. And I was just like, what? But it was at the time, it was just, you know, there wasn't the, maybe the level of acceptance or respect that there is now for people that work in the industry. And the goal was really to increase visibility, to sort of demystify the industry, to raise awareness of working condition and safety issues, and, you know, really, really humanize what was sort of a like untouchable subject really at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was, yeah, it was the person who actually coined the term sex work is a woman out of the Bay Area, Scarlett Harlow, who actually came on the tour a couple of times. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a real adventure, as you can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine.
And we went to theaters, galleries. A lot of colleges hosted us. And from that tour became pretty successful. And it was an annual tour, that ran for like 5 or 6 years. And out of that, I started being asked to book and tour manage other people's tours.
Right.
And that's when I started tour managing bands.
Yeah, when you say book and manage other people's tours, who were those people?
At first, it was projects. It was there was something called Sister Spit that was a spoken word project, and I booked and tour managed that. And I never booked bands. That is a job that I have great respect for and could never do.
okay.
And the first big music project that I tour managed was Gossip. And I knew them from seeing them play in their basement in Olympia. Mm-hmm. And, they got in touch and asked me to tour manage it was a Cyndi Lauper True Colors tour. and that was obviously a bus tour in stadiums. And I didn't, my level of understanding about tour management did not at that point extend to what it means to follow a bus tour around. And I was used to doing everything on the cheap, absolutely, you know, as cheap as possible. And Gossip at that point wasn't a big band. So they're, you know, and you're being paid opening band wages. And so I rented us a minivan, and we hauled our asses around behind Cyndi Lauper's tour bus and would show up.
And that was like at what time frame?
2005, maybe,
right.
Or six.
Oh, I think it says about 2007 here.
Oh, 2007. Saying, okay.
I'm not going to dispute your own
you
facts.
Should dispute my own memory of time because it's
all right. I'll bear that in mind. I'll bear that in mind for the rest of the conversation. But, all right. Well, this was all like, did you say you grew up in Olympia also, or you just sort of spent like your early adult years there?
Early adult years. I grew up in Detroit.
Where'd you grow up?
In Detroit.
Oh, right. Yeah. Detroit. Uh-huh. Yeah. You told me that before. How'd you make it out to Olympia?
I had this idea that I was going to go to the college out there. And I, they didn't have grades, and it was this, alternative college
kind of like Santa Cruz in California.
Yeah. Yeah. And I knew one person out there, and I got a ride with some person, this is embarrassing to say, who I met in a Grateful Dead parking lot.
Is that embarrassing to say? That sounds perfectly normal to me.
As you do.
Where else do you meet at a Grateful Dead show?
Someone who's going to drive you across the country.
Which show?
What show?
What year? Where?
I would have been 18 or 19 at that time. If that would have been like 94-ish or 5? 94?
95 is when Jerry died. There'd be like a few shows that year.
Okay, so it was 94 then.
94 maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
They did play some shows in 95.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, okay, so like 90s, yeah. Uh-huh,
yeah, 90. It would have been 94, and it would have been either the Palace, if it was an indoor show. No, I don't think it was. I think it was... I can't even remember the name of the other outdoor venue there in Detroit, but it was probably the Palace.
And he
was actually from Chicago. I got a ride with this. We were both painting faces for money and ran across each other in the parking lot and got a ride out to Seattle.
Okay. You left the Deadhead part out of your, out of the bio. So.
Yeah, I mean,
I think a lot of people do anyway. So leave it out.
Yeah.
But so you got a ride out there, you're thinking like this is like a cool place to live, and then were you into performing arts early, and that's kind of what gave you sort of this impetus, cuz you just sort of don't show up and do these kind of just kind of jump into this DIY space without having like a feeling like you're either a creative or you're kind of a manager? How did that sort of look with you in terms of how you got into it originally?
I mean, I loved going to see my friends play shows, I'm a Gen X person in their 40s now. And, I think there was just so much hand wringing about how we were this like generation that didn't give a shit about anything. And all we cared about was irony and detachment and whatnot. And the shows were sort of a live show is like a place where there's something so earnest about somebody getting up on stage. It's like a place where you have to admit that you give a shit about something because you're giving a shit about communicating with other people.
Yeah.
And I was never, I mean, I'm, I can read tabs and serviceably play an instrument, like the bass, to play like the world's most bare bones classic rock songs or whatever. I'm not a musician myself, but I love
right. But you love going to show. Love going to see shows.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And I remember, I don't know when it was in all of this, but randomly getting a hold of this book that was like a minute by minute breakdown of the first Woodstock festival, and it, from the point of view of the organizers, and it was how everything went. It was like the logistics of it, how what went wrong, what went right, but mostly it was like the traffic backed up in, you know, at this point, the toilets overflowed at this point. This is how the negotiations for using the land went down. Like all of the stuff that this handful of guys had, who obviously had no idea what the hell they were doing, did. And I remember getting in, feeling interested, feeling a little something being some bell being rung or whatever by that, and feeling like that was interesting. Not that I wanted to create a disastrous.
Just, well, they had no idea that so many. I cut that a ton of slack whenever I watched like those documentaries, because I just don't think they thought a lot of. They didn't think so many people were going to show up. So
yeah,
one entry road, yeah. No problem. We'll have 25,000 people there, and then like 350,000 people showed up.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm minimizing it just for time, but still, probably memorized the situation way better than I did.
No. You know? I mean, this was like decades ago. At this point that I read that even. So, but yeah, I remember that being the thing that was so interesting about that, even cool. Understanding that there was like there was somebody running all of that stuff. It's like, you don't even think when you're a kid going to stuff, somebody organized this. What did that look like?
Yeah. And like by the same token, the kids today don't realize that either, right? I mean, I just got, there was Lollapalooza here. They show up and just go bananas and like have a great time, which is fine, which is cool. Yeah. But you were intrigued with the inner workings and logistics from early on. And so how did that kind of manifest? Well, we talked about how that sort of manifested itself, but what were kind of the key stepping stones to before you got to this Cyndi Lauper tour that we'll talk about?
I mean, I was intrigued by it, but also just completely devoid of information about what that would look like. So it's just kind of a dangerous combination. I mean, it's, and like I said, I think so much of that came out of just being in Olympia and this idea that anyone could just throw these big events it's not like fake it till you make it sort of situation. It's like approaching it with almost no idea about what you're even faking. And if that makes sense. And,
well, give me an example of that, 'cause that sounds like a really good story.
I mean, I just doing that first tour and just with the sex workers art show and just having, no idea how you book and promote things, and just mm-hmm. cold calling people to come on the tour, cold calling venues to let us come there, and then them being like, where's your press kit? And I'm like, press kit, you know, ask a few people what a press kit is. You know, like just things like that. And you know, not knowing the word for tour manager, and being like 20, 24 or something, and having an older performing arts lady whose name shall go unmentioned, yelling at me in the middle of the first tour and being like, why the hell don't you have a tour manager? And I'm like, what's that? You know, like we're like marooned in El Paso. I was the only legal driver of both of the vans, which were not supposed to leave the state of Washington. And we're getting, you know, pulled over by the police in El Paso with just the most
way to read the fine print. Way to read the fine print, Tara, on the rental contract.
Yeah. Well,
what's that? Yeah.
Yeah. there were a lot of moments. And like,
those are all learning moments, right? Yeah. I mean, clearly you got up, you made a, you did a press kit, you paid attention to the fine print. Oh, who cared about that anyway? Yeah. If you don't get in an accident, I don't think it matters.
Or pulled over by the cops with a van full of absolutely deranged looking people.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, that you needed I had multiple times when promoters would be like, yeah, you didn't hit the break even point. And I'm like, the place was sold out. You were turning people away and there were people dangling from the rafters. There's no way I didn't. And having to get a door clicker for places that we weren't running the door and have someone stand at the door and click. Mm. There's a different response to, I think probably my experience is maybe different than if I'd been a man in some of those situations. There were a lot of moments where you could feel that vibe that maybe there were things that were scams that were being tried with me that might not be tried with somebody either older or, more male.
Or a dude. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. I'm sure you encountered a shit ton of that, right?
Yeah, it was.
Sadly.
It was.
Sadly.
That's definitely a thing. I mean.
Many challenges for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's true with bands. I mean, we had, Gossip has a female drummer, and I will never forget arriving in Italy for a huge festival that was, it was like an MTV televised festival that was mm-hmm. put on by them, and they had brought her a child's drum set. And I was like, "Are you kidding?
Who brought the child's drum set? The band,
the promoter brought our drummer a child's drum set, and they were like, "What?" Just like no.
Oh my god! All right, I lived in Italy for 3 years, and somehow it just doesn't surprise. That's just the funniest thing.
She was livid. Oh my god!
The drummer. Yeah, I would imagine, right? So how'd you solve that? I love that.
It was just this battle because there's you find two, like one of the things that you do encounter is, especially, I hate to say this, but I did encounter this a lot in Italy, but it's everywhere, and that if you say no, you have to say no, we're not fucking playing the show without this. God, with this goddamn child's drum set that's going to break in half.
Right.
You have to say no, and you have to insist on things multiple times before there's, oh, okay. So before somebody believes that you are the person who is allowed to insist on something before they're going to accept. And it was, the drummer Hannah, she's like, I'm not fucking playing this show. And it's like they make you get to the point where you're kind of being a bitch before they're like, okay, let's get an adult's drum set.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, you can break that down probably gender wise when, like, my first instinct is like, okay, yeah, maybe a guy would like just go to anger immediately, but to a woman's credit, perhaps there was a little bit more of trying to be nice, whatever that means. Right. And that could be also, that's a kind of a topic in and of itself. Right.
Yeah.
I'm saying,
yeah,
possibly. Right. But cause you didn't go to being an asshole right away. I'm not going to say bitch. I'm going to say asshole. You didn't go to it right away, maybe, but maybe you had to. And that's it. I don't know. It's interesting. Like the dynamic, I mean, it's just a kind of a subtopic of dynamics of how to get shit done. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which of course you kind of encountered a lot, I'm sure, in your role.
Yeah, I my last name is Perkins, and there was somebody, I can't remember who it was, but invented the verb Perkinsing, like you've been Perkins, which was me screaming at somebody to get something done.
That's a good compliment.
I did need to dial it back some. You never unleash that kind of shit on a service employee, or you don't.
Yeah. But now are you doing the same? Is that kind of doing the same thing to people that was done to you when someone like flipped their shit because you didn't have a press kit?
Well, I would use that with promoters or when things weren't things weren't on the up and up, then you can resort to Perkinsing someone. But I've reformed my behavior. I'm much slower to get surly now.
Yeah. I mean, the Portland woods will do that to you. The woods outside of Portland will do that to you. Maybe. I don't know. I'm making a lot of presumptions there.
Or worse. Or make you worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me about driving around in the van with Gossip following the Cyndi Lauper tour. That sounds interesting.
I mean, I just didn't. There's a big difference between
in 2007, I think we established.
Yeah, yeah. Between tour managing and performing arts thing and what bands do. And again, it was just a thing that I kind of stepped into without knowing exactly what I was doing and understanding, you know, that all the equipment on the stage and who's responsible for getting what and what the phrase backline means and all of this. There's a whole vocabulary that despite having done years of successful tour managing, there's a whole vocabulary that I didn't even know. And you know, with that tour, it was the first proximity to people like Cyndi Lauper and Erasure and like all these people that were on that tour and touring at that level where you roll up to like some big stadium in Boston, and unload your stuff. And like Debbie Harry was on that tour.
What was it called? Oh, it was Cyndi Lauper True Colors Tour. So it was a bunch of different artists.
Yeah.
Was it kind of it was almost like a rolling kind of, what do you call the tours where there's just a bunch of different acts on it? I don't know if there's a name for that.
What is that? I don't know.
Whole concept, like the Warp Tour, those kind of things where it's just like a bunch of artists that go, huh?
It was,
that sounds cool.
Debbie Harry. God, what was that band that had what was the man that the Dresden Dolls?
I don't know them.
It was Amanda Palmer's band. They were like the other like kind of baby band on it. And then there was like Erasure and Blondie. And then randomly like Margaret Cho and Rosie O'Donnell.
Just for some comedic relief in between sets.
Yeah.
And you were working with Gossip at that time.
I was just the tour manager for Gossip, not the manager at that point. And I rented the cheapest possible minivan and rented our hotels on Orbit. So they were, and we were, you know, all staying in one hotel room. Pretty quickly, Beth got sucked onto the Cyndi Lauper. Cyndi Lauper had her own bus, the Star bus, and she Beth got sucked onto that bus. So it was,
who's Beth?
Beth's the singer of Gossip. Sorry.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, and she was lucky enough to get to ride on the bus, and then we would just have to get up at an insane fucking hour and haul ass to catch up with because a tour bus travels overnight, and so it's not meant for people traveling during the day, and so we'd either have to like drive
or the tour
drive
set up like that.
And then later
you would which would you usually choose? Would just depend on the distance to the next stop, whether you'd go on the drive at night or if it's too long, I get up super early in the morning. God,
yeah.
What did you prefer? How did you figure that out?
It was actually better to drive at night. We figured that out our way through and not leave everything to chance during the day. Cause if something happened, like if you get stuck at the border, then you could end up,
well, you're reflecting on European, right?
Well, no, we went into Canada with them. But yeah, I mean, oh God, then
there's always better to have a buffer between, I think, where you're supposed to be at what time. Right?
Yeah.
I would be hard to sleep after a show for anybody, I think. And then it's like, so why not just start driving? That would be kind of my philosophy.
Yeah. Right? It's much smarter to just
with
do
enough
that.
Coffee.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah. Leave the drunk people in the back, whoever's driving, just get going. And shortly after that, Gossip's manager at the time reached out to me and was like, oh, their tour manager for this European tour has just gone MIA. We're not hearing from them. We don't know what the hell's going on, and the tour is in like a week and a half. Can you go? And I was like, sure. And I had never even been to, thank fucking God this did not happen, because it would have been an absolute disaster. It would have been the one complete failure of my learn as you go thing, because it would have just never, I mean, touring in Europe is a completely different thing. And it would have been an absolute disaster. There's just so much to know and so much stuff I wouldn't have known. And he did.
So you told him no.
I said yes. And I started getting stuff together for it. And then he kind of resurfaced at the last minute.
I thought we were talking about you had spoken about being in Europe with Cyndi Lauper. No, sorry,
that was just the US. We went over into Canada. That was the one border crossing that I was mentioning.
Before I thought you mentioned something about actually being in Europe with Gossip, but sorry.
I did go with Gossip on the tour that this other person managed. That was my first excursion to Europe was.
And what year was that?
That if the Cyndi Lauper thing was 2007, then it would have been later that year.
All right. So you got your chance to go and do then and manage the and Gossip back over in Europe. You got your chance to do the Europe tour. How was that?
It was amazing. It absolutely blew my mind. I mean, like I said, I had never had the chance to travel there otherwise.
Were you ready for it for that one?
Just to be clear, I never ended up tour managing a tour in Europe, a full tour. I went over with them on the tour that other person ended. I was, when they asked me to tour manage it, I said yes. And I started to get stuff together for it. And then I didn't have to tour manage it. I just got to go on it as sort of like Beth, the singer at that time, had a lot of sort of side projects going on. And she asked me to help her with some of those. And that's how I ended up transitioning into management. Was through going on some of those trips with them. And she was like, I want to do a book deal. I have a book deal going. I want to do a clothing project. I want to do these other things. Can you come on to manage those? And then from there, I started doing band management. But the early European touring, there was so much. I was the manager, but I came on every tour, and managers don't normally do that. And so some of the tour management role, the role was just this mess of being a band manager and being a tour manager light, and being some of the things were even like assistant level stuff. I was like, you know, dealing with their record company, and then at the same time, making sure that everybody had enough food to eat and things, you know, taking care of like the absolute micro things and then the biggest things.
Yeah. Did you enjoy doing that?
Yeah, I do. I love logistical problems. I love solving things. And I also love solving problems before they happen. I'm not that interested in being on stage, which I'm really relieved about. I think there's a lot of frustrated performers and frustrated musicians in my kind of role, which I consider an administrative role, really. And that's, you know, that's great for people that, you know, that they've found a way to, who are interested in being musicians, but are instead administrators, who have found a way to at least be in the industry. But I'm personally relieved that that's not my feeling, and that I just love being a part of the background of helping a show happen and helping, you know, happen. Cause when Gossip is, I don't know if you've ever seen them or watched any videos, some of the early or mid 2000s festival videos, watching them live, it's just like, it felt like seeing the explosive sort of absolutely freeing energy that you'd see when you'd see them in their living room in Olympia, but it's on a stage in front of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. And there was not a beat skipped, but there was nothing lost between the energy of, you know, of like 2001 versus 2012, when they'd gotten to this level where they were playing massive festivals. Mm. And and from my point of view, I love being a part of setting it up and making that happen.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, that's the live music experience, right? I mean, it just gets into your blood and your and I applaud you for just for wanting to put it out there and get it out there and run them around and make sure that all happens for everybody. What's your tell me a little bit about the fans and that you've encountered and what as you're taking a band around and as you're managing this tour and as you're working with Gossip, what are your thoughts on the live music kind of experience from your own perspective and what you've seen over the years?
Well, the fans, I mean, Beth is her word would be fat lesbian, fat queer punk. And, in the early days, I mean, she was appearing naked on magazine covers or billboards, back in 2011, 2012 or 2009, really, actually, now that was when the record came out. I told you I'm unreliable with time.
That's okay.
And, it was, there was no body positivity movement, which there is, you know, kind of a mainstream movement for that. There was nobody else doing that at that time. And for that reason, I mean, they were always much bigger. They were household names. They had huge radio hits in Europe and not in the US. I just don't think the US was ready for a person like that. But, the upshot of her being this sort of loudmouth, not giving a shit about being fat and queer and showing up in fashion spaces or wherever, was that the fan base was absolutely maniacal. I mean, there were so many young people to whom she would just like meant the absolute world. And there were people showing up with tattoos and really early on, you know, Beth Ditto or Gossip tattoos and
tattoos of her.
Of her, yeah, and crying. And
yeah, that's cool.
She's
that's amazing.
Always, you know, had to be sort of ripped away from talking to people or interacting with them. And she would, it did not matter. Their biggest standalone show was an arena, Bercy in Paris. Which is a 22,000 capacity. That was their biggest headline show. And she took her mic and walks out into the audience, is climbing around the whole circumference of the thing with the microphone and talking to people and dragging people on stage and just really hands on and interacting in that way. And that's not the way every band runs. Can or should run their live shows. That's not what, you know, it's not what every live experience is like. But I was really drawn to that sort of breaking the wall between audience and band, because that's at the heart of the sort of twee, you know, Pacific Northwest post-punk aesthetic, is that there's not, you know, there isn't a difference. Anyone can do this. And that was, it was cool to see that vibe being writ large at big festivals.
I mean, like it brings fans into the production. They kind of feel like they're part of it.
Yeah.
Like anybody can do this or anybody can be part of it. And this is sort of an affirmation of that, the notion that, you know, if you could be up there, it humanizes the process with that interaction with the front person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
It was,
it's intriguing. I know several bands that do that. I mean, the National is like the most striking example from my own musical world, that, you know, Matt Berninger will go out there and just be with would the fans just jump right into the pit?
Yeah, yeah.
And just walk around and sing and involve people. But what you're saying with what Beth does is amazing. Was she, and that certainly adds to like this incredibly colorful and amazing fan experience. But even more so when there's so much more at stake from a gender perspective, from what she is communicating with her audience and what she means to her audience, from what you've told me.
Yeah.
And that's really, that's super compelling. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
You mean about what?
Yeah, but just what she really meant to her fans and what the fans, you know.
I mean, like I said, I did go on, most managers don't go on all of the tours, but I did for the first, I don't anymore, but I did for the first few years that I worked with them. And I'm so glad I did, because for one thing, as an aside, you can sign the biggest deal and make the hugest, most amazing thing happen for an artist. But if they have like a shitty seat on the plane, you know, that's the thing. That's the thing that
you suck.
And like you failed.
Yeah, exactly.
You really like grasp like why that is. They're not just being like divas. It's because being on the road is so fucking challenging physically, mentally, emotionally, in every way. And you know, I it also just gave me the opportunity to really see how people responded to her. And we'd get letters, or you know, adults bringing their daughters backstage, coming to talk with her. There's fans who we now, the band and sort of the, and even the crew, have years long relationships with people. There's a woman, DJ Lindsay, I'd love to shout her out. She first started coming to shows, and we were like, who is this? She's British. And we're like, who is this weird fan? She'd done drawings of the band and brought them food, and was like, I think she was in Manchester at the time. And she was, you know, a queer person, and having this like loud out queer band was like a big deal for her. And she had brought snacks and made these beautiful drawings and all this stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And but I was like, who is that? Don't eat anything she gives you. She could be anyone. And
then, that too, right?
Yeah. But
the concept is great.
Over the years, I mean, she came, I think the number is now over 100, the number of gossip shows she's come to. She came to, she spends all of her money working as a security guard, going to see shows of gossip, and then one or two other queer artists. And I think her 50th show was gossip at Terminal 5, and they did a couple nights at Terminal 5 in New York, and she flew over for it. And Beth brought her up on stage, and everybody sang to her. And,
Well, that's cool. That's great. That must have been really super meaningful to her. Wow.
Yeah, it was awesome. And she started an organization for raising awareness of queer people in football, British football, soccer, in sports in general.
Yeah.
And we've donated stuff to that. You know, it's just and there's multiple people like
that's
that
great.
Who over the years we've developed ongoing relationships with, and who Beth has taken under her wing in some way or another, and put them in videos or things like that.
That's great. So she's put her money where her mouth is, basically, like in terms of like she's like representing this self-empowerment, but also actually helping.
Yeah, yeah.
Not only. I mean, and I don't mean like to say the performing's not helping, but also like real world helping.
Yeah, participating
also.
In things else. I mean, she would probably
giving of her time.
Not be, you know, she would not like that. She keeps a lot of that stuff under, you know, that she donates or spends time with people. That's not something that she would brag about. So I don't mean to do that on her behalf, but she's really generous with her time and energy. And it's like when I've seen the this crazy stuff that people will say to her, you know, because she's fat, in even well-meaning people and in interviews. I've seen journalists say wild stuff to her, or people online say crazy stuff about her body or all this stuff. And she's, you know, really threading this needle of finding a way to open herself to the positive energy and not to the also just like fire hose of anti-fat and anti-queer vitriol. And she's, I just think it's like, I really think with all performers, people really underestimate the amount of emotional energy and the intensity that being around, even people that are having exclusively positive experiences, it's like, or largely positive experiences as performers, it's such a psychic drain, even when it's a wonderful, invigorating drain, it's a drain. It's, you know, and you really can see that with someone like her, and someone who's so wants to give of themselves all the time. And it's definitely a wild thing.
So on that note, do you feel like you need to be kind of the a touring psychologist as well?
Oh yeah,
to help with those things.
I mean, yeah. I definitely think so. I think that's like so much the role of a tour manager or a band manager. I mean,
is it though?
It ends up being, I mean, in a lot of cases,
I mean, in a larger sense, do you think like the majority of those, I don't know, I've talked to a lot of tour managers. We've never really talked about being the psychological support, but maybe we didn't get into that, but in your instance, that seems to be like something that's really important.
I mean, and I don't, maybe that's my personal approach, but we've worked with a number of tour managers over the years at multiple different levels. And above all, you need someone to be competent with the logistics, period. And we've definitely had people who were somehow tour managers, I don't know how, who were absolutely not. But the most effective, the most effective people are, as in my experience as tour managers, are ones who are able to run the logistics super smoothly, have great connections, you know, and are able to hire a great monitors person, a great able to hire great people around them for all of the roles, and then can sort of vibes tech the whole thing, who understand when a person, an artist, is getting burnt out, who understand the moment, like, at this moment I can be like, hey, get your ass to the stage, come on, or I'm going to give that person, you know, 10 more minutes to freak out in the bathroom and get their shit together before going on stage. You know, there's just a lot of, there's a lot of personality management that is just so critical to that job. And
That's cool.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Yeah. One of the one.
The same performing arts grand dame who yelled at me about not knowing what a tour manager was. One of the other things that she said on that tour was there are no shortcuts through people's personalities. And I didn't understand it for a long time. And touring and band management really made me realize like what it means is like, you can't use your, you need to get from A to B. You need to get somebody to do something, whether it's go on stage, go the fuck to bed, get in the van, whatever it is, your path is not the way to get there. You have to navigate their personality. You have to get into their shoes, for lack of a better phrase, and see what they need to get them from A to B. And I think that the best tour managers are people who really get that and are able to help their artists do that.
And you believe you're good at that?
I think most of the time, yeah.
Yeah. You're very humble. It sounds like you're probably good at it all the time. I mean, it depends by what measuring stick you use, right?
Yeah, I try. I mean, I think that there's so many famous instances of artists just getting burned the hell out. And I mean, I remember watching the and no commentary on her managers or her, but the Katy Perry documentary. And there's this scene where she's just like fucking crying and like laying somewhere backstage, I think, or just she's crying and she's so overwhelmed and fried out, and just the managers are just kind of standing next to her being like, you know, not really being like, there, Katy, you know, so obviously uncomfortable with it. And it's like, an artist is not a person, is not like a cash cow that you just like ride into the ground and,
you know, and milk indefinitely.
Yeah. And then when it's done, you hop off and find the next one, you know, and it's like, there's so many, you know, Amy Winehouse it's like, Beth performed at the Brits, one of the Brits that she was at. And I saw her backstage walking, she's walking like 8 feet ahead of just bobbing and barely standing up eight or 10 feet ahead of her whole entourage. She's just kind of behind her twiddling their fingers and obviously not knowing what to do. And it's just like, it's an emotionally trying industry. It just is. And it's, and you need to, people need to be taking care of each other and watching out for each other's mental health. And
yeah. Do you feel like you have a special perspective for some reason, or you're just kind of an empath that allows you to kind of understand what these performers are going through in a special way, even though you haven't been a performer yourself, so that you can help coach them through certain difficult situations that they might encounter? And this kind of also translates into your more current work as a band manager.
With Sam.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that there's something that I have a special skill. I guess I would describe myself as an empath or somehow driven to like, to caring about what people's experiences like, and, mm-hmm. you know, probably maybe overly moved to try to fix situations for people and make things comfortable for people. There's not a really big line in the sand between my role as a band manager and tour manager, really. I mean, they're super different in a lot of ways, but they're also, one bleeds over into the other. And there's, to this day, there's situations where it's like, oh, we're doing a one-off private event, I'll just TM it and we'll, you know, go to Paris for 3 days. And, you know, it's not worth bringing somebody on.
Oh that. Yeah. Of course you'd say yes to the Paris deal.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Man, jeez. You know what? Yeah. You know what? I'll take that one.
Yeah. Don't worry. I got this. Yeah.
Yeah. It all sounds good, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's all that stuff, you just sort of learn it as you go, and you learn stuff to let, stuff to not care about too. I mean, early on, there were definitely, you know, things that I'd worry about that I later realized weren't priorities for the artists, or weren't things that were consequential, that even ridiculous stories like they Gossip played, Art Basel, and the Jeffrey Deitch, the Deitch Projects, brought them down there. At that point, he was in an era where he was like working with the downtown artists, that kind of art scene of kids. So, Kathy Grayson, who now runs Hole, was working with him, and we got brought down there to play this show,
So Art Basel in Miami.
Yeah. And they let us choose who we wanted to have do the stage set. And we chose this collective from Australia that we had met and loved. And anyway, at the show, Beth was like, everyone come on stage. Cause it was still so time-wise close in proximity to when she would do that, in olden days. And I don't even know if she said it or if people just expected it, and she whatever, everyone jumped, came and was dancing on the stage and was I ended up going onto the stage and putting my body in front of the drum set. Cause I was just like, everything is going to get broken. And I've got to make sure that that things stay upright. And what, and it was just like, there's no need to worry. It's just like rock and roll chaos, and just, you know, let the drum set get broken in the spirit of the moment. I was on my hands and knees trying to protect the kick drum and stuff. It was just like, no, don't worry about that.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about a little bit your transition over into like just managing bands. And I think it's interesting because I had just spoken to Christian Coffey, who tour manages for Run the Jewels, Childish Gambino, ASAP Rocky. And he started out earlier managing, but then got into tour managing because he just was like, was just a better progression for him. But your progression was sort of the opposite way, and now you're doing artist management. Can you talk about that sort of transition a little bit and what that looks like? I mean, you did say that you're still tour directing a little bit on the, you know, when that's necessary, but what is that, how did that transition kind of come about, and what does that look like for you?
I mean, it was really Gossip asking me to do that, asking me to come on as manager of the full band. And I did, you know, when I started tour managing them, there was a lot of stuff that the management at the time wasn't available for and seemed strange to me. And I, you know, I did have the thought that, oh, I could do that. And I wouldn't do it this way. And they asked if I would, and I was like, sure. Again, another situation where I didn't go to school for music management or anything like that, and it was a learn as you go, for better and sometimes for worse. But it's tour management is really, really hard. I mean, it's anything that goes wrong is your fault, is ultimately your fault. It's really difficult. It is constant. I mean, my role is also constant travel, but it's constant travel. It's grueling. You're up before everyone. You're asleep after everybody. I just think that after a certain amount of time, you get, you can get fried on that. Or I did anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people that are my age or even older that have done tour management their whole lives. But for me, it was, I'd have a hard time imagining myself being able to, be living that, constantly living that lifestyle indefinitely.
Right. Okay.
It's just, yeah, it's just a lot. And you're, unless you get on with a really a band that's really big and tours all the time. I mean, everybody has down cycles in their touring cycle. Everybody's going to have off time. But you're around different people all the time. I mean, sort of the middle level of the touring ecosystem, like indie rock bands or just, you know, mid-level bands, the people who do, you know, you do like a 2 or 4 month run with a band. It's not like you're tour managing Pink and she's spending 4 months just in Australia alone. You know, like it's like where the tour cycle is like a 2 year thing. It's like, it's really more like a few months. And so then you're constantly like needing to find a new job and needing to find and working with a whole new set of people and a whole new set of chaotic personalities, and not just work with chaotic personalities, but live in extremely tight quarters with chaotic personalities. Right. And
you became an adult.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit. It sounds like, I mean, not to say that adults don't do this job, like, but I don't know, you know, it's like a natural progression of just like kind of growing out of it a little bit, but some people kind of go the other way. I think they don't mind it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know? at the level that he's touring, I mean, though he's working with the you know, lighting directors and stage directors that are at the absolute top of their games, and he's not having to, there'd be tour assistants and people that can there'd be such a bigger infrastructure around, which is great, you know, that it makes that role so much better.
Yeah, I get that. So tell me a little bit about the acts that you manage, and what does your sort of business look like today?
COVID has changed it a lot. I dropped a couple of artists at the beginning of the pandemic. It was, you know, like you with management, you want to have a mix generally of new artists and developing artists, and developing artists, I mean, music is subjective. It's not a meritocracy. You can have a band that you think is great or that is great, and it can just be the wrong commercial moment, or things just don't align, or some piece of it is not what is fashionable at that moment, or something about it, you can't get it across the finish line. And you can work your ass off on something and put an enormous amount of time into something, and because we work on commission, you may never get paid. It's so harsh to the things that are really great that don't get to a level that you want them to. It's just such a bummer, you know, to think of the music that people won't, you know, that won't be heard on a big level. And with so much of my income essentially evaporating at the beginning of the pandemic, I'm just like, I don't have it in me to do free work for people. I love you, and I'm still a resource for you, but I can't manage your developing project anymore. And so I let a few artists go, and another band that I was working with, Lowered Ends, who I love so much. They're based out of Baltimore. They're a domino and ribbon band. They were actually on tour when COVID hit, and we were in this position of being like, what is this? What should we do? Should we cancel the tour? Should we not? You know, and for that, the music is littered with sad stories of COVID career interruptions. But in this particular one, it's like they had spent a couple of years making a record. They did an opening slot for of Monsters and Men, and then finally this was their headline tour for that record, and we had to stop before they got to their East Coast leg. It was like
so many stories.
And they're, you know, they've been a band for years and years, and they are you know, at this point in their 40s, and they were like, we're not going to tour again after this. This is it, you know. They're not planning to make music anymore. That it shifted them out of music. Stuff's changed a lot since the beginning of the pandemic. I'm still working with Beth and Gossip, and Gossip spent a lot of the pandemic making a record in Hawaii, of all places. The producer that they're working with is based down there. So that, that's what led to that. And mm-hmm. they're still finishing up the record. And then Beth has been moving into film and TV acting. And and has just she's got a show that's going to start filming in September. So
right,
it's been one of those moments where it's like, okay, time to sort of emphasize some of the stuff that doesn't involve some of the revenue streams that don't involve live touring. That can kind of keep stuff afloat.
Why are you not? So what's what's kind of like a really cool thing that's happening with one of your bands going forward in the fall? Is anybody touring or that you're managing, or what's kind of the big picture?
I mean, I just don't think the fall is going to be about live show. I mean, I don't want to speak negatively about anything that anyone else is doing, but it's really hard for me to see with the way the numbers are going right now and how everything's going. It's just like, I'm not sending anyone out on the road in the fall. And with Gossip, the fall will be finishing the record, and Beth will be filming her her TV show. And Velvet Negroni, another artist I'm working with, is finishing up a record, but we're not planning any live shows. I mean, there's definitely been a few offers coming in, but there's just, you know, stuff that it's hard to see a scenario where in September it's going to feel great to bring people into a you know, 3,000 person venue in Brooklyn.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of tours that are booked out there right now, but yours is a very rational decision. I mean, but these are tours that have been booked for months now, and now kind of, I mean, we're doing this interview in mid August, and, well, hopefully, well, we're talking into the future here, but you know, this won't be published for, you know, several weeks, but, you know, let's hope. And things are changing just so quickly now. It's hard to tell what's going to be going on. But yeah, the safe bet is to sit on the sidelines if you got other things going on, I guess, you know.
Yeah,
that's possible. I'm kind of glad things are getting out there. But, you know, we'll see what happens. I'm just hoping that the industry doesn't get shut down again. I'm glad for that. And I'm happy to wear a mask at a show.
Oh, yeah.
And be vaccinated. I'm just like, get vaccinated and wear a fucking mask. Duh. Worst we've seen, like you say, like worst things can happen, then you got to wear a mask. And we've seen what that looks like, and it was fucking horrible for everybody in the industry. Nightmare. And it was also boring. It's also boring.
Yeah, super fucking boring. Yeah, it's crazy. It's who knows what the hell things are gonna look like. I mean, I think people are starting to get creative. I don't work with anybody that loves the streaming experience. I think certain artists really work so well with that. I love my friend Christian manages Angel Olsen. I love what they've done with the with the streaming stuff. There's so many people that have done a great job, and they've just killed it with that. And I just don't work with anyone who would thrive in that format, but it's cool.
Well, it's not going to be like that forever, but there's some creative people out there for sure.
Yeah. And venues, you know, outdoor stuff feels different to me than indoor stuff. And I'm sure people will find ways to be outdoors. And the minimized capacity stuff, it's like the finances of touring just don't work at that.
Yeah.
You know, with that, those structures.
Like limited capacity.
It's hard.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain ways that can work. I mean, and there's other ways that it doesn't. It kind of just, it's the big economic picture. But I'm glad that people are at least trying to get out there. That was happening a lot over the, like, you know, in the spring and such, and that seemed to work. But you know, if you're looking for profit at that moment, it may not be the best model. You know that better than I do.
Yeah.
But it's also for bands, we're doing it because they just want to be on the road and play.
To be on the road. And
the actual economic situation was, it was kind of like a weighing process of like bands needed to get in front of fans.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, and they could, you know,
play the music that they put out live. Yeah.
Right. Wow. Yeah. It's an interesting world out there, Tara.
it's a real moment.
Yeah. Well, thanks for spending this time with me. I really appreciate it. And, God, you've done such so many interesting things. It's really cool to hear your story, and I'm really really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me. I'm so curious to hear about your what's drawn you to live music and what your attraction to everything is. I can ask you off podcast or on.
We'll talk about that. Yeah, okay. For sure. But you know, people that listen to the podcast have heard about my kind of story as I go along.
Yeah,
but
I'm sure.
Yeah, love live music. Love to be here. Love to talk to people in the industry, and then bring that to people that also kind of feel the same way. And you know, to interview artists and other industry professionals is just kind of like, you know, what we do at Roadcase. So
awesome.
And you're part of that whole big picture. So thanks for spending the time with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Right on. Take care.
Take care. Bye. Bye.
Okay, that was Tara Perkins on Roadcase. Really loved sitting down with Tara and chatting with her and learning more about what she does. She has been in so many different types of situations. Was really eager to get out on the road early on. Loved her DIY spirit and kind of taking me through that journey and what that looked like for her as she sort of learned as she went. That's kind of a learning for everybody, really. I mean, she just took the necessary steps, figured out what she didn't know, and kind of moved forward. Really interesting to hear kind of the gender differences in management and how, you know, she doesn't want to be called the B word, obviously, but had to really put the hammer down at times. And, you know, that difference between being a guy and getting out there and hollering at people, and then what Tara was doing. And that was kind of interesting to hear her characterize that as being Perkins. And, you know, I guess you don't want to be Perkins when you're out there. But, you know, she was also very interestingly, as a tour manager, really cognizant of the struggles of performers, the mental strain. And Tara's self-admittedly an empath and understands easily kind of some of these problems, and became sort of the ad hoc psychologist on tour, which is kind of part of what tour managers do, or a lot that I talk to as well. And that really came to light in her work with Gossip. And I enjoyed hearing a lot about that kind of dynamic of the performers on stage and kind of the shit that they take from people sometimes, and how that is really weighs on performers. And I talked to a lot of performers on this show about how difficult it can be just to be up on stage, but then to be called out for what your body looks like or what you look like has just got to be incredibly difficult. So that was a really interesting perspective to hear from Tara. And of course, now she's in band management with the company Hardline Management, and I wish her the best of luck in doing that. And I hope we can catch up with her again at some other point on Roadcase. Thanks again for tuning in for this episode. We got a lot of great episodes coming up. You can follow us on Instagram at Roadcase Pod to hear the latest information on episodes that are coming up. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. So thanks everyone for your support, and thanks for being here. And I want to send a special thank you for Tara Perkins for spending the time with me on this episode of Roadcase. Thanks again so much for listening. And I'd like to encourage everyone to get involved with Roadcase. You can do so in a number of different ways. You can email me at info@roadcasepod.com with questions, comments, and even suggestions for guests. Or you can follow us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Roadcase Pod. And we have a YouTube channel called Roadcase Podcast. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. And if you could please rate and review the podcast while you're there, that would be great. So I want to thank Waltzer for this awesome theme music that we have. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to Roadcase. We have a lot of great episodes coming up, so I'll see you on down the road.